Welcome to Season 2 of Policy Implications Podcast, where policy meets research. I'm your host, Olga Zadrozhna from Kuzminsky University, where I teach on the research in empirical economics. My guest today is Professor Tatiana Derugina, who's an Associate Professor of Finance at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Tatiana's research focuses mainly on environmental risks and evaluation of social and economic costs of natural disasters and air pollution. Today, we'll be discussing her recent paper called Geographic and Socioeconomic Heterogeneity in the Benefits of Reducing Air Pollution in the United States, co-authored with Nolan Miller, David Molitor, and Julian Reif. By looking at the U.S. elderly population, this paper tries to understand who are affected by the acute air pollution the most and where these people live. So welcome, Tatiana. I'm very happy to have you on the podcast and be discussing this research with you, especially given the fact that we're getting closer to colder month. And in Poland, at least, colder weather brings higher air pollution. So I hope with this episode, we could bring more awareness about air pollution and its negative consequences and give policymakers advice on how to tackle it. But before we start our discussion of the paper, please tell us more about your research and how did you become interested in this topic?
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here, Olga. This is a part of a longstanding interest of mine to think about how the environment that we live in affects health. In general, I became interested in environmental economics because it's a very challenging field to work in. Economists typically like to work with prices and quantities and markets. That's what people traditionally think of as an economist. But there are aspects of our lives that are important for our well-being, which economists very much care about, that don't have markets. For example, air pollution. There is no market for clean air unless we create one. So economists have thought about how do we bring economic tools into these important places where there are no naturally occurring markets. And part of understanding, for example, how much air pollution we should have, because we can't eliminate it all, that's very difficult, but we also don't want to just let air pollution run rampant. Part of that involves quantifying the costs of the air pollution. And that's what I've tried to do in some of my research. And so understanding what are the health costs, both in terms of mortality and hospitalizations and other outcomes, is a really important question for crafting optimal policy. And so I became interested in this topic, hoping to inform policy about whether we're regulating air pollution too much in the United States, or maybe not enough. And so far, my research has shown that we still appear to be regulating it not enough in terms of there being more benefits. So I don't necessarily research the costs of reducing air pollution, but my research sheds lights on the benefits of doing so.
And so what are the main harmful effects of air pollution that we know of from previous studies, especially on the health of people?
That's a great question. So far, I've just been using the term air pollution. But in practice, there are several important air pollutants that people should care about. For example, there's ozone that gets produced when cars emit certain compounds that then react in the atmosphere. And ozone can be particularly harmful to people who have asthma or other breathing difficulties in the short run. We know less about its longer run effects, partly because it's harder to trace chronic exposure that people face. The air pollutant that I have studied the most is called fine particulate matter. So this is a broad term that refers to any particle that's 2.5 micrometers in diameter or smaller. That's smaller than a human hair. These particles are invisible. They're made up of a lot of things like emissions from power plants, emissions from cars, lots of things that humans use can emit particles or other chemicals that become some forms of fine particulate matter. Fine particulate matter can also cause respiratory issues. It can cause cancer over the longer run. It can cause cardiovascular problems both in the short run and the long run. And we know some of this from associational studies that correlate levels of air pollution with outcomes. But I think even more credibly, this evidence comes from some laboratory studies where either animals are exposed to high levels of these pollutants or humans are exposed to either really clean air, because we don't want to expose people to really dirty air deliberately. So we either expose humans to really clean air or normal air. And then by measuring the difference, for example, in cardiovascular performance, you can see the effects, or you can measure the effects that the air pollution is having. Sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, these are other air pollutants that are typically emitted by power plants.
Right. And so in the US, the main air pollution policy is based on the so-called Clean Air Act. Could you please explain its main idea and whether other countries have similar approaches to tackling air pollution?
Sure. So the Clean Air Act has been around since 1970. There was actually even a predecessor before it, but it wasn't very effective because it didn't give the federal government much power to deal with air pollution. And there have been significant amendments in 1977 and in 1990, further giving the US government the power to regulate air pollution. The basic idea is that the Environmental Protection Agency of the United States sets county level standards for the different air pollutants that I described separately, because they're measured in different units and harm people in different ways. And then areas of the country, the US is divided into counties. So counties that do not meet the requirements then have to come up with a plan for how they're going to come into attainment. So these counties are called non-attainment counties. And if you're not in attainment with these standards, you have to come up with a plan to bring yourself into attainment. Since these standards have been put in place, they've been tightened over the years. For example, originally, the levels of ozone that were allowed were much higher than they're allowed today. Initially, the EPA focused on so-called total suspended particulates. These are bigger particles than fine particulate matter. But over time, as new evidence emerged, the EPA has moved to regulate smaller and smaller particles. If a state does not come up with an implementation plan for the non-attainment counties, or if the EPA deems it unsatisfactory, it has a number of things that it can do, both in terms of withholding funding, not allowing new pollution sources to open up, and so on. So it's actually fairly complex legislation. Another thing that the EPA has done is added some tradable permit markets that allows polluters to trade permits, still maintaining the standards, but allowing for more flexibility in meeting them. The EPA can also review new proposed sources of pollution, even for counties that are in attainment. So if a new power plant, coal-fired power plant, wants to open up in even an attainment county, the EPA has the right to review that under the Clean Air Act. The basic framework of the Clean Air Act is used by many other countries. And by the basic framework, I mean setting a standard for air pollution that an area has to meet, and then having some penalties if an area does not meet those standards, being able to require certain pollutants like power plants to adopt certain pollution control measures. The Clean Air Act also gives the EPA the power to regulate emissions from cars. So lots of rich countries have policies like that in place. The European Union has its own framework that is broadly similar to the Clean Air Act, but will of course differ in the details because it's a complex legislation. When it comes to poorer countries like China or India, they also have air pollution legislation that's broadly similar. But for example, in the case of India, it's often not enforced. So it might look like, okay, so, you know, the government can regulate and mandate that polluters install certain pollution control equipment, but in practice, it does not get done. The legislation in poor countries also typically lags in terms of keeping up with new pollution sources and really having the power to enforce and the will to enforce this legislation. But in terms of the basic framework, it is widely used around the world.
Right. And so in your paper, you suggest an alternative approach to be used in air pollution policies, saying that policymakers should not only look at air pollution levels alone, but also at pollution vulnerability. So what is this pollution vulnerability? How do you measure it? And why do you think this new approach is better?
Okay, so I should say we don't necessarily think this approach is better. It's a complementary approach that can be used in conjunction with targeting high pollution areas. So as I mentioned, the EPA currently classifies areas as attainment or non-attainment, and essentially every sub-legislation or every piece of pollution regulation out there does go after higher pollution areas first, which makes sense in some way because every additional unit of pollution causes some harm. But what we point out is that people differ in how vulnerable they are to air pollution. For example, somebody with asthma is going to be a lot more vulnerable to ozone, but also probably to fine particulate matter than somebody of the same age who does not have asthma. Now, pollution vulnerability could be multidimensional, and we don't necessarily understand everything that makes a person vulnerable to air pollution. So what we did is we used new techniques in machine learning. So it's a statistical tool that allows you to trace out relationships in data where you have a lot of information, some of which might be irrelevant. So the algorithms essentially identify the relevant pieces for you. And so we use data about their past claims history, how many times they've been hospitalized, what medications they're taking, how much they've spent. And we use that information, we throw it into the algorithm, and predict how vulnerable these individuals are to dying from acute pollution exposure. And by acute, I mean kind of short run spikes in air pollution. And so we're able to come up with an index, and we estimate that about 25% of individuals in this elderly population are vulnerable to these acute shocks. Mortality risk does not go up significantly, but for these 25%, it goes up significantly. Even within that, there is heterogeneity. You can look at the top 1% by this vulnerability index, and they face even higher rates. And then we're able to basically map where these vulnerable people are in the United States. And we document that there's a lot of heterogeneity in the share of a county's elderly population that's vulnerable to air pollution. So if it were uniformly distributed, you'd expect that about 25% of the population would be vulnerable in each county, because on average, about 25% of the population is vulnerable. Instead, what we see is that some places have less than 10% of the population that's vulnerable by our metric, and some places have over 50% of people being vulnerable. And so we show that too, that the share of the population that's vulnerable is actually negatively correlated with levels of fine particulate matter. So in terms of targeting areas with higher share vulnerable, there is a trade-off between that and targeting areas with higher pollution levels. And the benefits of targeting places that are vulnerable is that, of course, potentially higher return per unit reduction, because you're targeting not based on pollution levels, but you're looking for people who are particularly sensitive to higher pollution levels.
Right. And so why do you think there is this negative correlation between higher pollution and the percent of people who are vulnerable to it? So is there any endogeneity, as we call it as economists, there? Or like what happens in those communities?
So it's really difficult to say because our measure of heterogeneity is so multidimensional. We have, you know, thousands of predictors in there. We do know, for example, what are some of the important ones. So having lung cancer is a huge predictor of being vulnerable to fine particulate matter, which is perhaps not surprising. Obviously, if you have lung cancer, your lungs are already impaired. And so having more pollution harms that. And then we can think about why do some people have more lung cancer? Probably because they're more likely to be smokers. And the distribution of smoking in the United States is not random. And it may be that people in rural areas, which could be less polluted than urban areas, tend to smoke more and also experience lower air pollution. So there's not necessarily causality here. We're not claiming that higher air pollution causes the share of people to be vulnerable, but it could be. It could be that vulnerable people leave areas that are very polluted. And then you would get this relationship between pollution levels and share vulnerable because of the so-called endogeneity. We can't really tell those explanations apart. We're really framing it as something that policymakers can target, but why it's there, we can't take a strong stand on, though we can suggest some possibilities.
So what is your advice to policymakers? What should they do to tackle these problems and to protect the vulnerable?
So I think considering vulnerability in thinking about, for example, this new source review that the EPA implements, so looking not just at pollution levels when thinking about whether new sources would be allowed, but also what are the characteristics of the people that live in the area. As part of our work, we produce a map of vulnerability. So in principle, this information could be used by policymakers to improve their decision-making about where to allow new sources, where to target funds for pollution reduction and so on. Again, we don't think this information should be the only piece of information used. There are other considerations as well, like air pollution levels, like the cost of reducing air pollution, potentially some environmental justice issues as well. But we think our results can be another important input into that decision-making process.
And do you think your methodology can be also used in other countries, like Poland, for example?
Yes. So I didn't go into too much detail about methodology, but it's not very data intensive in some ways because we use wind direction as a source of variation in air pollution. So in principle, the hardest challenge is getting the data on predictors of vulnerability. We have these health claims data that allow us to have a very rich space through which vulnerability can be predicted. Without that, we could still estimate the average effects of air pollution on mortality, but we couldn't estimate vulnerability. So if there is information available on people's health utilization, then I would say our method can be implemented there. Of course, we also produce some correlates of vulnerability in this paper and in another paper. And these can be used indirectly as well if the rich data on utilization is not available.
Perfect. So the policymakers should definitely collect more data and analyze these data. Thank you very much, Tatiana, for this interesting discussion. And I do hope that we can together tackle the problem of air pollution. Thank you.